The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Well, welcome to a Friday, and happy Juneteenth, everyone. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network. Yeah, we are now live at 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific. Still working some of the bugs out of the system, but hey, baby steps, and that's what it's all about, right? So we've got a busy show for you today. A man who, well, we got to know because he made a lot of appearances on television. Congressman Eric Swalwell of California is our guest today. But you know what? I was never really a big fan of Eric Swalwell's until I saw him in action during the impeachment inquiry when he really shone. The sound is scratchy again. Okay, so Diane Russell, I'm listening on YouTube. It shouldn't be scratchy. Distortion in the sound a little bit. Okay. Okay, everyone's saying please fix the audio. Hold on just a minute. Let me ask, is it only on YouTube is hot and Progressive Voices is playing an ad? Lovely. All right, so if YouTube is hot, let's pull this down a little bit and you guys tell me if YouTube gets any better. Progressive Voices should not be playing an ad. All right, yes, it's fried somewhat. Fine on your phone. Okay, it is not as bad as yesterday. Okay, hopefully it will improve. It's clipping a little bit. Ugh. All right, I'm working on it. It's Friday. Hopefully the weekend will allow me to play with it a little more. Okay, so hopefully it gets better. I think it's a different scratchiness. Working on it. Just so you know, I'm working on it. All right. If all else fails, go to get the audio at NicoleSandlerStream.com. It's better now? Better now. Cool. Okay. So, as I started to say, it is Juneteenth, and it's a busy day, and it's a good day. I got to say, despite the orange idiot's belief that the world revolves around him and his inane statement to the Wall Street Journal, the quote was, "I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it." Well, you know, Donald Trump, just because you're an idiot and just because you're uninformed doesn't mean that nobody had ever heard of it. People have known about Juneteenth since 1865. However, this country does not teach Black history in our schools, even with the month of February allegedly devoted to Black History Month. School kids in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the site of Trump's Nuremberg rally now happening tomorrow so as not to conflict with Juneteenth today, were never taught about the Tulsa race riots, also called the Greenwood Massacre or the Black Wall Street Massacre, that happened happened May 31st and June 1st, 1921. Yes, 99 years ago. In fact, I played this clip for you last week or the beginning of this week, but I'm going to play it again because it's relevant. 60 Minutes had a piece last Sunday on this Tulsa massacre, because that's something that really none of us had heard about. I mean, I looked at my husband and said, "I feel stupid. How did I not know about this?" And then we watched the 60 Minutes piece and listened to this moment from that segment.
"The death of a Black man at the hands of police is today shouted into the national memory.
Thanks to all of you for being here."
But in 1921, it remained possible to erase a genocide.
"I grew up attending segregated Tulsa public schools. Never in any of the schools was anything ever said about it."
The congregation of Vernon AME Church is two generations beyond 1921, but they too were victimized.
"This was not taught in the public school."
No,
You never heard about this in class.
You never heard a word about it.
When I went to OU in 1998, I was sitting in a class of African-American history, and the professor was talking about this place where black people had businesses and had money and had doctors and lawyers, and he said it was in Tulsa. And I raised my hand and said, no, I'm from Tulsa. That's not accurate. And he was talking about this massacre, riot. I said, man,
wow.
What are you talking about? I said, I went to school on Greenwood. I've never heard of this ever.
Okay, so that's a guy who grew up there in that neighborhood and never heard about this. Again, because black history is not taught in this country. Hopefully that will change. So while that, the Greenwood massacre, the Black Wall Street massacre, wasn't widely known, we have known about Juneteenth. But Donald Trump knows nothing. And sadly, the rally that he has now moved to tomorrow will go on as planned. We just got a ruling from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. A lawsuit filed on behalf of local residents, business owners, and a community center in the historically black neighborhood of Greenwood earlier this week had demanded that the arena adhere to social distancing guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or that the event be canceled. Well, the Trump campaign has said it will take the temperature of supporters entering the arena and hand out masks, but that masks are not required. So, the Oklahoma Supreme Court today rejected an appeal of the lawsuit attempting to block this indoor rally. The plaintiffs had sought a temporary injunction, but according to a copy of the complaint, Paul DeMuro, an attorney for the plaintiffs, had argued that it was madness to let the event proceed as new coronavirus cases in Tulsa are spiking. But the court said that the state's June 1st reopening plan allowed business owners to use discretion over social distancing measures, and they were not mandatory, as the plaintiffs asserted. So the Oklahoma Supreme Court said, sorry, this is, sorry, but this event is going to go on as scheduled. All right, so YouTube is still running ads. I'm going to try to trigger the end of the stop set that shouldn't be running in the first place, and we'll see if this helps get things back to us. Yeah, I'm not real happy about this. Hold on one second. So we'll do that. We'll do that. Enter. Send. Hopefully the tune-in promos will end in a moment. Okay, so instead of going to Tulsa tomorrow, I have a better idea. Join the Reverend Dr. William Barber and the Poor People's Assembly and Moral March on Washington. It's the largest digital gathering of poor, dispossessed, and impacted people, faith leaders, and people of conscience. It's happening tomorrow, June 20th, 2020. And all you need to do is go to June2020.org. Got that? June2020.org. There's a two-hour program that'll stream live at 10 a.m. Eastern. It'll repeat at 6 p.m. Eastern, and again Sunday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Okay, so that's something else you can do while these idiots are all infecting one another in Tulsa. But we also have a song for the occasion. Oh, yes. Again, it comes from the very prolific Founders Sing. Yeah, we just had one 2 days ago. And so the Founders Sing are back with another video. I will post the video on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. But for those of you just listening to the audio stream, just know on the video, the person singing is Brad Pitt. Okay, it's not his voice, but it's his body singing in the video. And the reason Brad Pitt was chosen, I understand, is because he's an Oklahoma native. All right. So with no further ado, a little bit of advice for those in Oklahoma. This one from the Founders Sing is called Stay Home, Oklahoma. Take it away. Mm-hmm. better than Alabama, I guess, or maybe not. Now they will make you sign a waiver just to make sure you won't sue. You won't sue. Lord, they piss me off so much. They carry on exploiting you. Now that's the truth. Hey, Founders Sing is the name of that group, who's so prolific and so creative. In addition to the fun song parodies, they make great videos as well. And yes, I will post that on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/6/19-20 for 6/19/2020. Yeah, and Brad Pitt, look, I guess it's fitting. Why not? He's one of us. That's the advice he'd give. And he did famously play Dr. Fauci on Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And the background singers, too, right? Bill Moyers was one of the backup singers. That was awesome. And I'm sure it made a few right-wingers' heads explode because, you know, they're Lynyrd Skynyrd fans. Anyway, today is Juneteenth, the holiday celebrating the day when the last slaves were finally freed. You know, I saw somebody posted something, you know, that until 2 weeks ago, they never heard of Juneteenth. And I you know, I called them out on it. And somebody else said, to be honest, I hadn't heard a whole lot about it either. And you know what? I learned about it, I got to say, within the last 4 or 5 years, because as I said earlier, Black history is not taught in schools. They can name February Black History Month, but it doesn't make it so that we learn about what our people went through. So let me give you a little bit of history. And I found this. This is from an article that, frankly, I shared on this program last year on Juneteenth. Because last year I really wanted, because a lot of people didn't know what it was, and I wanted to educate us. And of all places, I found this article in Teen Vogue, who, by the way, has done great work lately. Seriously, Teen Vogue. And it was written by a woman named Jamila Nasheed. And she wrote, Juneteenth isn't the other Independence Day. It is the Independence Day. So let me share with you a little bit of history, because we're all learning right now. And especially people who look like me, we're really learning. So what we learned from what I learned from this article is that Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. It was intended, we were told, to free all slaves. But in August of 1862, President Lincoln wrote an open letter to Horace Greeley, then the editor of the New York Tribune, in which he described his actions as intent to preserve the Union rather than abolish slavery. Here's the quote from Lincoln's letter. He said, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. Huh? And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save this Union." That's an end of the quote. Jamila Nasheed continues writing, "Famous for his honesty, Lincoln clearly viewed his decree more as a political tool than as a means of liberation." She continues, "Its impact bears out. bears that out. Lincoln's 1863 Emancipation Proclamation declared, quote, that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious states are and henceforward shall be free. This meant that the proclamation only applied to states that had seceded from the Union, leaving slavery intact in border states and southern states under northern control. In addition, she writes, the promise of the abolishment of slavery was contingent on the Union Army winning the Civil War, which didn't happen until April of 1865. So we're getting mixed messages here, right? But even after that, the Union had to enforce emancipation. In Texas, approximately 250,000 people were still being held in slavery. When on June 19th, 1865, Union troops led by Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas to announce that the war had ended and that all slaves were now free. 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. So Granger delivered General Order Number 3, which said, quote, the people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between an employer and hired labor. Now, although slavery wouldn't legally end in all states until the December 1865 ratification of the 13th Amendment, June 19th, which became known as Juneteenth, was the day when the last American slaves were freed, resulting in massive celebrations. And celebrations continued every year since. In 1866, the year after Granger's orders, the first Juneteenth anniversary celebration happened. And since then, celebrations in certain regions of the U.S. have continued this tradition of honoring this important day. In 1872, a group of former slaves put together $800 and purchased 10 acres of land in Houston, Texas, for the city's annual Juneteenth celebrations. They named the space Emancipation Park, where Juneteenth celebrations are still held today. Year after year, small pockets of the U.S. have erupted in celebration of the day when everybody in the U.S. was declared free. But the day has still gone largely unnoticed in the majority of the country. So we're looking to change that. And in fact, Kamala Harris was on MSNBC last night when she broke this little bit of news.
Together with my colleagues, Cory Booker and Tina Smith and Ed Markey, we are proposing and dropping that bill to say that Juneteenth should actually be a national holiday.
And they did that today. And apparently, John Cornyn of Texas is a co-sponsor. So maybe things are changing. Maybe they are changing. Of course, we still have the orange idiot who said about tomorrow's rally.
The numbers are very minuscule compared to what it was. It's dying out.
No, it's not. The numbers are on the rise in Oklahoma, here in Florida, in Texas, around the country. But, you know, they're claiming it's a hoax. I got to tell you, my kid may be starting a new job in a couple of weeks. And sadly, her soon-to-be boss is a Trumper. And when she expressed trepidation about coming back yet because of the spike in cases here in Florida, he expressed to her, oh, that's just a hoax that the media is putting out to, you know, to influence the election. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. I'm just blown away. All right. I'll tell you what, we have Congressman Eric Swalwell coming up in a few minutes. He's got a brand new book out. It is called, oh, what is the name of the book? Oh, Endgame. It's called Endgame. And it's about the impeachment of Donald Trump. And he had a front row seat to it. I'm excited to talk to Eric Swalwell. So I'll tell you what, before we get to that, let's try this again. We'll take a little break. Hopefully it won't last too long, but we're checking out the system. So Progressive Voices, tune in listeners, we're going to take a quick time out and we'll be right back. All right. For everyone else, I thought I'd share with you another song that we will dedicate to the people who are intent on going to the stupid rally tomorrow. And even more than that, the people who will not wear a face mask because they're sticking it to the libs. Now, I played a version of this last week, Jill Sobule's latest song. She has a new video for it. So I thought, well, Progressive Voices is in a commercial break. We'll check out Jill Sobule's new video for giving it to the libs, giving it to the libs. All right. Take it away, Jill Sobule.
Oh. I went to the rally. I took all the kids. We wear our hats proudly, giving it to the libs. Went to church last Sunday. You know what I did? I hugged everybody, giving it to the libs. I'm giving it to the East Coast, giving it to the West. Here we know we're not a hoe. We don't need no test. I tried hydroxy, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not sick. Can't think of a better way, giving it to the libs. I'm giving it to Hollywood, New York City, New Orleans. Have you got your government check yet? Mine I haven't seen. I went to the Hobby Lobby. I took all the kids. They touched everything inside. I'm giving it to the libs. 3 weeks later, I woke up this morning. I could barely breathe. Mercury rising 103.
Uh-oh.
Now I'm in the ER waiting for a bed. The nurse, she wears a garbage bag. The guy next to me is dead.
Oh, no.
I'm giving it to my cousin, her poor husband, too. My niece with diabetes, and I'm giving it to you.
Uh-oh.
I went to church this morning, and you know what I did. I got buried in my MAGA hat. I'm giving it to the libs. I'm proud to be an American. I'm giving it to the libs.
Ah, Jill Sobule, everybody. Let's do one more song, okay? One more from Lauren Mayer.
The countries fighting the virus the best have one thing in common with which we're impressed. They take vital steps without willful defiance, and unlike some places, believe actual science. Yes, it takes a woman, a leading woman, a president, premier, head of state, to handle crises fully, unlike some bully who just wants to brag and dominate. In states and cities where protests did swell, the ones led by women are handling it well. They know how to listen and not raise objections, and they're not afraid of asking for directions. Yes, it takes a woman, a leading woman, a governor, a mayor, a chief. 'Cause when you're led by women, confident women, you frequently see some relief. Why is this country still so hesitant? By now we should have had a female president.
Oh, yeah.
Electing women can frequently lead to the flexible, more open mindset we need. Plus, in general, women have calmer demeanors and don't need to brag about the size of their... So
yeah.
Let's cheer for women like Jacinda Ardern, Gretchen Whitmer, Laura Kelly, Carmen Cruz. And then there's Angela Merkel, Sanna Marin, Tsai Ing-wen, so many these days in the news. Now, I'm not saying women are inherently brighter, but they show things by just being there. They're like the brown M&Ms in a Van Halen rider, a sign things are inclusive and fair. And it's not anti-men to believe in women and think they might have the right stuff. Let's give a chance to women, elect more women, because men have run things long enough.
Yeah, Lauren Mayer, everybody. Oh, hold on one second. Thank you, Lauren. Lauren Mayer. Oh, it takes a woman. Yes, it does. All right, welcome back. It's the Nicole Sandler Show here at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. And I see that our guest has entered the room. So let me bring him in. Eric Swalwell is the is a congressman from California. We've gotten to know him over the past while from his numerous appearances on television and his wonderful questioning, frankly, in the during the impeachment inquiry. And now he's got a new book out. It's called Endgame. Congressman Swalwell, thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Nicole, for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And, hold on. I've got to get your video shot up. I do everything myself. I'm sort of a one-woman show here. So
good for you.
People see a lovely photo of you and a picture of the book cover. And so while I get your actual video up here, we can chat for a moment. So the book just was released this Tuesday. You're in very crowded company, but good company. I guess this is the beginning of summer, you know, beach reading season, if we ever get to the beach again. So tell us a little bit about Endgame. You tell us what it's about while I get our shots.
You know, Nicole, you're right. It's right around the time that John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened book comes out. But I was actually in the room where it happened, in the room where holding the president accountable was on the House of Representatives side, where we heard from courageous witnesses like Marie Ivanovich and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Fiona Hill. And it's really a testament to their courage. It's a condemnation of the cowardice I saw from too many Republicans, and also a call to action that we now have to impeach and remove the president at the ballot box, because that's the only remedy for, frankly, this national nightmare that we've been living for the last 4 years.
Well, we absolutely do. And you know, I was one of the people who was not really happy that you were not chosen to be one of the impeachment managers, because frankly, during the inquiry, you did a really great job of questioning. I was very impressed. I thought you were a shoo-in. Were you surprised? I mean, I'm guessing you threw your hat in the ring if that's how it worked.
I wanted to, and I talked about that in the book. I wanted to do it. I wanted to frankly do whatever I could to help the team. And one of the parts that, you know, the public probably didn't see was just, you know, the solidarity and the unity among the teams, both the Intelligence Committee and Judiciary Committee, and Val Demings and I were the two that were on both. And you really bond when you're going through something like this. But, you know, as disappointed as I was when it was announced, I realized it wasn't about me. This was about the President of the United States needing to be removed. It was a decision for the Speaker of the House to make, and she alone. And the team that she sent over there was phenomenal. And they did the best job they could. And frankly, only one Republican, Mitt Romney, had the courage to follow the evidence and not put their own careers above our national security.
Now, were you surprised about that? Did you expect anything differently or different? Or did you did you think that any Republicans would come around and do the right thing?
No, I believe the case that we put forward should have moved them to do that. But we also were holding out hope that, you know, perhaps some of the witnesses who were reluctant to come forward when we put our case on, maybe once it made it to the Senate, would come forward. People like John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney. And they didn't. It was because the Senate essentially gave them an alibi by never subpoenaing them. And so, no, I'm not surprised. And, you know, in the book, Nicole, I laid out that, you know, I had a lot of friends when I first went to Congress in 2012 on the Republican side. And I saw this transition from being able to work with them, you know, not necessarily on every issue. But once Donald Trump came into power, first phase was denial. They were in denial about the fact that he actually won. They would privately express concern about his embracing of Russia. But they would also express fear that if he tweets at them, as one of them said, he wins. And then in 2018, once we won the House and beat 41 of them to flip the House, you saw that they were in full-on enabling mode. And that's what we saw. They took out the shovels. They helped them bury the evidence as much as they could. And that's why I'm convinced that we need a reckoning now in November. Otherwise, it's going to get worse.
Without a doubt. Now, Congressman Swalwell, you mentioned, of course, John Bolton again, and the fact that he didn't testify. I mean, I'm out here screaming. I understand. I want to read the book. The revelations we've seen so far are stunning. You know, kind of what I thought we'd see. But I'm not. I don't want to put any money in his pocket. This is a man who didn't stand up as an American citizen and do the right thing. He saw all this stuff and was in the room when it was happening and decided, well, I'm going to hold off until I can collect a paycheck from a book instead of testifying before Congress when he was asked to do so during the inquiry and then again during the impeachment trial. Why do we have no recourse when it comes to having a public servant testify before Congress?
Because the president and his team have defied the congressional subpoena power. And they think that if they don't show up, they don't have to answer for what they've done. And so we're now going through the courts to see if Congress does indeed have a subpoena power. That's why this tax returns case is so important. And we expect a Supreme Court decision on that as early as Monday. But going back to John Bolton, remember, we subpoenaed him in the House and then he said, I'll see you in court. And we felt the urgency to act that we weren't going to wait months on end to see him in court while the president was trying to rig an upcoming election. And then when it went to the Senate and he said, I have information, well, Chairman Schiff asked him to at least submit an affidavit and he wouldn't do that. So now, you know, him showing up with this book and these disturbing revelations, it's like a firefighter showing up with his fire truck and his fire hose. But the building is now in rubble and ashes. It's like, great.
Right.
Where were you when we really needed you?
Exactly.
But nothing is surprising as far as what he's alleged.
No,
it
now
fits
no.
The pattern of a president who would welcome interference, put his own interests above the country's. And again, I think it just has to move people now to the ballot box.
Now, would you consider subpoenaing him now, even though it's, I mean, what's the point? We need to now just get him out of office. But is that something maybe down the road that you would consider doing? Because, look, even if we do hopefully get Donald Trump out of the White House, we need to hold him accountable for what he's inflicted on this nation for the last 4 years and beyond.
We can't take the ankle monitor off this president until January 20. 2021. So I do believe we have to, you know, vigorously use our oversight power. And I know Chairman Schiff is considering all of the options available to us to make sure that we do that, including whether or not we would subpoena John Bolton. But I'll leave that to the chairman. I think he's very wisely and effectively led us for these past 2 years.
Right. So Congressman Eric Swalwell is with us. You have two Twitter accounts. You have Eric Swalwell and Rep Swalwell. I know you follow me at Eric Swalwell. Was it one so that you could do your personal business on one and do the business of Congress on the other?
No, we're under really strict rules in the House. So anything that we do for official business with taxpayer dollars to communicate constituent resources or what we're doing in the House, that has to be under at Rep Swalwell. And then at Eric Swalwell is a personal account. So it reflects, you know, understandably the rules that make sure that taxpayer dollars aren't abused.
Well, thank you for that, because there's such a blurring of those lines, especially with this administration. I mean, Trump goes on these trips, like, for instance, the thing tomorrow in Tulsa. It is a campaign rally, and yet he uses official resources, and I believe pays a lot of uses taxpayer dollars to do these things. I realize that trying to perform oversight on a president such as this has got to be really difficult. There's a statement. We're online, so I'm not under the auspices of the FCC, so I can curse. But with Trump, it's like they throw all this shit against the wall and see what sticks. And there's no way, even with a dedicated, diligent press and Congress trying to perform oversight, that you can handle, that you can confront each one of these things that he throws against the wall. It's so much. On any given day, there's multiple things. Trying to cover it all and stay on top of what he's done is exhausting. And for you guys, there's no way you can deal with all of it. So how do you pick and choose what you try to call him out on? Or is how frustrating is all this?
That's a great question, because he does not believe in or follow the rule of law. They, as I said, they defy subpoenas. And in the book, I laid out that during the Russia investigation, for example, that started when the Republicans were in the majority in the House, we would bring in Obama administration officials, former officials, and every single one of them honored their subpoena, did not put any qualifications or limitations on their testimony. And then when the Trump witnesses would come in, whether it was Jared Kushner, Hope Hicks, Don Jr., mm-hmm. they would refuse to testify anytime we got close, you know, to what the president was doing with Russia. They would just say, I refuse to answer. I refuse to answer. The number of times I heard that during their interview. So they believe they're above the law. And the only way to, you know, really enforce these subpoenas is to win in the courts. And if we're not going to win in the courts, we need to win, certainly need to win at the ballot box, and then have in 2021, you know, a reshaping of the courts that believes congressional subpoenas matter, that believes in the independent prosecutions from the Department of Justice, because this president has just taken a wrecking ball to so many of the institutions that we've always counted on.
Right. You know, the hypocrisy is not surprising at this point. We come to expect it from the Republicans. But the fact that they're now throwing out subpoenas to investigate, as Donald Trump calls it, the oranges of the Russia investigation is astounding. So they're okay with those subpoenas. You just can't subpoena anyone if they're a Republican. The same way Donald Trump says criticism of anybody is fine as long as they're not Republicans. If you criticize a Republican, according to Trump, you're a traitor and you're guilty of treason. I mean, I get that he's uneducated and doesn't understand how government works. But this is your fourth term in Congress, right? And so obviously you were there under Obama, which at least was a functional administration. How much of a difference is there between the way the Obama administration operated and the way the Trump administration does things for you as a member of Congress?
You know, I remember during, I believe it was 2017, there was a hurricane that had just before Maria, I believe it was Irma, it had wiped out Saint Martin,
yes,
which is a split between the Netherlands and the French. And there were about 10,000 U.S. Citizens vacationing there. And I was working, you know, with the State Department at that time to try and, you know, figure out how we could get U.S. citizens out of there, off the island, because there was no power and it was really starting to get chaotic. And I realized early on, just administratively, that no one could sign off on any of the efforts that were being channeled through me, of people who were offering private planes to go in there and pick up as many U.S. citizens as possible, trying to come up with options to, you know, marshal resources to get citizens off the island. And anytime we would start to make progress, I was told, well, the person, we have to run this even farther up the chain because we only have acting assistant secretaries or deputy secretaries. And that was intentional. It wasn't that the Senate hadn't moved to confirm the president has a Republican majority in the Senate. It's just that he doesn't believe in government. So put aside the corruption and, as you said, being uneducated, unethical. He just doesn't believe in government helping people. And so he hasn't filled the positions that can help people in a time of crisis, like during those hurricanes, as we're seeing right now during the pandemic, where they shelved the pandemic playbook. And so he just doesn't believe in government, and we're all paying the price because of it. And that's not what we saw with the Obama administration.
Right. Yeah. As much as, look, I disagreed with Obama on a lot of what he did. I'm further to the left. I wanted to see a more progressive administration. And frankly, what he ran on, and that's not what we got. But oh, my goodness, just knowing how they functioned as an operational government and seeing what we're dealing with now is just incredible to me.
And I have another example for you, Nicole. During those Russia interviews that the Republicans led, and sorry, I'm running a startup preschool here.
You can hear it. Awesome. That's wonderful. I'm all for kids and dogs making noise in the background. That's fine. Oh, so, hey, sweetie. Oh, she's
adorable.
This
is Cricket.
Cricket? Oh, she's
Cricket.
Cute.
Yep.
Hi, Cricket.
Thank you. So it was interesting. There was not, the scheduling of witnesses was not always purposeful or intentional. It was really just around availability of witnesses. So one day you would have someone like Susan Rice or other senior officials testifying before the committee, and they were professional, knowledgeable, dignified. And then the next day you would have Roger Stone, and you would have, you know, just all these different clowns and characters that were on the Trump team. And it was, for me, the best contrast of, you know, where we were, people who, again, cared about government, cared about helping people, again, put the politics aside. They've just had experience and knowledge and ethics. And then you had this, you know, freakish clown show that had come into Washington on the Trump train. Mm-hmm. And it just, that was very, you know, jarring to see that.
Now,
just the contrast.
The whole thing. Now, you know, you're also a lawyer, and that was very apparent during your questioning. And you sit on both the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committees, two really plum assignments. And I'm glad you're there because you're very effective in there. But as an attorney, seeing what Bill Barr is doing to the Justice Department, does it make your head explode? I mean, me as just a layman, civilian, I couldn't deal with I call it opposite world, where nothing makes sense. In is out, up is down, left is, well, not right, but you know what I'm saying? It just, and he is just undermining the rule of law on every front. How do you deal with something like that, especially as an attorney and a member of Congress? Yeah.
I come from an office in Oakland, California. It's the Alameda County District Attorney's Office. And Kamala Harris was a prosecutor in that office. But most notably, Earl Warren was a prosecutor in that office. And he came in and cleaned up a corrupt system that during Prohibition, you know, was enabling kind of the underworld of crime in Oakland. And he cleaned it up. And that was reflected in the Miranda decision and some of the other decisions that he ruled on to make sure defendants had more rights. And so the mantra in our office, and I talk about this in the book, is we do justice. And so I'm pretty, I would say, old school when it comes to the mixture of politics and prosecutions. I really think prosecutors have to be independent of politics. And I cringe when either a Republican or a Democrat tries to weigh in and tell prosecutors, you know, what they should do with the case. I think it's okay to say something's right or wrong, but to try and use political influence to tell a, you know, whether it's the attorney general or anyone else, what type of charges they should bring. I think we have to let the evidence guide what we do and nothing else. And with Bill Barr, it's just enabling Donald Trump's, you know, political preferences.
Yeah.
And I hope the next person who leads that office is a true prosecutor that, you know, thinks about equal justice under law with little regard at all.
I hope so, because Eric Swalwell is our guest. I'm reading your book, Endgame. I apologize. I'm not as far enough along in it as
I
hoped. But I just got
it.
Oh, sure. And it's fascinating. And especially since we lived through this, you really are the book goes through what we lived through last year with the from the impeachment inquiry through the impeachment through the Mueller report. And I just earlier today read the section on the day of Mueller's testimony and how, you know, the media went with, well, it wasn't the bombshell we were hoping for. So, you know, impeachment's over. And you lived through, I mean, we put so much hope into Mueller finally just exposing this administration for what they are. And then Bill Barr, so it's released, and Bill Barr puts out this 4-page alternate universe explanation of what's in it that had no bearing on reality. Again, I could sense your frustration because all the work you guys did all that whole time leading up to the report, and then they lie about everything. They lie with such impunity. You don't expect that from the attorney general, even if he is Donald Trump's attorney general.
And Nicole, it felt like, again, we had both hands behind our back because all we were saying was let Mueller do his job.
Right.
You know, we were not, you know, trying to influence where the prosecution went. We were just saying, let it follow the evidence. And then, as you pointed out, Bill Barr immediately comes out and mischaracterizes what Mueller had said, to the point where Mueller had to send a letter, if you remember, mm-hmm. calling out Barr for mischaracterizing what he had found. And then, yeah, the media, I think, did want a Broadway show. And I talk about an exchange I have with a pretty well-known television anchor who texted me during the hearing and said, I think you guys are losing if you're hoping Mueller's going to save you. And I wrote back to this individual and I said, well, he's not trying to win a Tony. He's
right.
trying to lay out evidence of one of the most complex criminal cases ever investigated in our country. And so if you listen to what he said or if you read the report, it's clear the president welcomed what Russia was doing. No prior Congress had ever envisioned writing a law to say you couldn't do what he did. We certainly have now. But he also committed 10 different crimes of obstruction of justice that by his own Department of Justice's standards, he can't be prosecuted for.
Right.
So what I point out in the book, Nicole, is that after the Mueller report, although the press panned it, there was a cascade of members who got on board with impeachment because they were so concerned about what they had heard and read.
Right. Right. Well, Democrats, of course, and they should have been, and Democrats are the only ones who read the report. Republicans didn't. There's such partisanship when it comes to oversight, and it shouldn't be there. But, I hate to keep bringing up John Bolton, and I don't agree with anything he says, except one thing that I heard that he says in his book that I do agree with. And I did when it started, when Nancy Pelosi introduced the articles of impeachment, and there were only those four. When again, there was so much shit thrown against the wall that there were hundreds of things you could have chosen from. My thought was give them a lot so that some Republicans can actually say, okay, well, I'm not going to go along with these, but this one, you know, give them a way to say no to it. But so do you think that was a mistake to only introduce those four articles of impeachment and not throw the book at him and really take him to task for everything he's done?
And I talk a lot about that in the book. So I don't think it was a mistake. It was it was intensely debated because there was a camp of, ring him up for everything he's on the hook for. And the other camp, and I think this is where I agreed with the speaker in the sense that we had to cut through to the American people and keep it as simple as possible. And so the team of Lawrence Tribe and, you know, some of the outside folks, you know, who were advising us on this, they really believe that when you look at the founder's intent and the Federalist Papers, abuse of power is the greatest crime a public official could commit, not just in the United States, but they went farther back to in the British system when we were a colony. And so the concept of a person using their office, you know, to essentially commit bribery, that is the highest crime and misdemeanor that you could commit because it's a crime against the Constitution. And so
Right. We
wanted to keep that, you know, very, you know, clear and to the point. And then the second article, of course, was obstruction of Congress for the just blanket refusal to cooperate with any of our investigations. But it was, Nicole, intensely debated. And I think just recognizing the urgency to act and the need to make sure the public understood what we were doing, we landed on two articles.
So, okay. So
he's good for probably 100, right?
Right. Okay.
There's no disputing that.
I gotcha. And he is. And he should be brought up on charges. Do you believe that if Donald, this is a two-part question, if he loses, which he should, that he will leave voluntarily? And once we get him out of office, do you believe that he will be brought up on charges and held accountable for everything he's done?
I think he faces criminal exposure. Yes. I believe you have the obstruction of justice issue. I mean, God knows how prosecutors are going to view what he did with President Zelensky in Ukraine. I remember mm-hmm. Bill Barr, they said in like a couple days, they looked at that and then said that there's no crime there. That doesn't mean future prosecutors cannot look at, you know, welcoming foreign interference or a contribution from a foreign government. There's this new allegation from John Bolton, which will have to be investigated with
China,
not only the Chinese, but also Turkey.
Right.
You know, what the favors he was asking, the favors that Erdogan was asking of and what he was doing. And then, of course, he is still individual one. So I think he faces vast criminal exposure. But to the more immediate question, do I believe he will leave office? No. But one thing I know about Donald Trump is that he is a coward. And mm-hmm. this is what we saw with the impeachment investigation. Only once we launched it did he back down. Only once we launched a congressional investigation did he back down and actually give Ukraine the money that had already been voted on
that's
and
right.
that he had signed into law. So I believe that's a call to action for us to overwhelm the ballot box, not even make it close, so that it's easy if some young military officer or Secret Service agent gets the order that you have to go tell him, you're no longer the resident of this house. You got to go. But if it's close, that's where you can envision him summoning these, you know, supporters
gangs
of his who have stormed state capitals in Wisconsin and Kentucky mm-hmm. and Michigan, you know, in their camouflage
and their guns,
carrying their AR-15s. Yep. You can see him trying to play into that confusion. But if it's not even close and it's a blowout, I think that's where he just backs down and
well, he's got to. And I don't know about you, but I'm a bit heartened by the recent members of the military, former members of the administration who have come out in recent days and said, you know what, this is wrong. He's a bad guy, from Mattis to Kelly to, you know, that makes me think, all right, the military is not going to protect this guy. They're going to protect the country. And I have to hope that that's the case.
And Nicole, when you saw him make that walk from the Rose Garden to the church right
it's
outside
horrific.
Lafayette Square yep. with his massive entourage, you just have to think that he believes those are the people, the ones that used chemical weapons, you know, on peaceful protesters, the ones that cleared the way with him and walked as an entourage. He has to believe that those are the people that will protect him. And that's why it's all the more important that senior military officials, former officials, speak up and signal to current military officials that we have a rule of law,
yes.
we have a peaceful transition of power, and they may need to be called upon because we don't know what this president is going to do.
Without a doubt. There's so many more questions I have for you, and we're getting close to the end of the hour, so we'll do a little bit of a lightning round. What did you learn from your run for president?
It's very hard,
but
you know, I would say I learned a lot about the country in the sense that people in South Carolina, in Iowa, and New Hampshire take their role of vetting a president so seriously.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a second job. And that was really heartening to see. And it gave me a lot of respect for anyone who's ever run, and especially anyone who's won. Because of the vetting that you go through, the excruciating and, you know, painstaking days. But I also learned it's a real test of confidence. And, you know, I was ready for the long physical days and hours of the campaign trail. But I mean, every single day you wake up and it's a test of, you know, mental confidence. And so when I think about, you know, Joe Biden, I think this is his third or fourth time, you know, running. Like he's a tested candidate, and he's been a vice president.
That's one way to look at it.
yeah, but he's he's carrying himself with the confidence that you need. And you need to have confidence on the trail. And I think that was something that, just being candid with you, that was harder for me to, you know, get my sea legs throughout the race. I loved it. I don't regret doing it. Okay. I would have regretted had I not run. And on the issue of gun violence, I really believe, you know, we elevated that issue. And on my first debate night, I was able to get a number of candidates to commit to assault weapons ban and buyback, which I think is the only way to get those weapons of war.
That's awesome. And thank you. I live in Coral Springs, Florida. We're right next door to Parkland. Yeah. So, look, we've all been touched by gun violence, and it's criminal that we still don't have an assault weapons ban. So thank you for that. You think you'll run again?
I don't think so.
No?
Again, I would have regretted had I not run. And the best advice I give to Nicole, to my interns who ask what should they do if they want to run for office, I think it's the best advice. The advice I give them is don't run for an office, run on issues. So seek out the issues you care about in the community and you'll find the office. But if you just say, I want to be in this office, so I'm going to run for this and this and this and climb my way up, I think people will see through that. I also think it never plays out the way you expect. And you could also be demoralized by losing on one of those, you know, steps that you don't serve at all. And so I'll continue to care about ending gun violence, you know, climate, student loan debt. And I think I'll find the best way to serve. That's the advice I give my interns, and it's the advice I follow myself.
Gotcha. And one last question. During the debates, you did make a point of the generational aspect of it, and maybe it's time to bring in a new generation of leaders. Once we get past this election, is it time for a change in leadership in both the House and the Senate?
Well, thank God we have Speaker Pelosi there right now, right?
And right
I
now.
Think there is an exception to every rule, and she's the exception to every rule. Thank God she's there. But what I have played a part in, and I lay this out in the book, is leading an effort called Future Forum. And in the last election, 29 members in their 40s and under were elected. They're the most diverse group of candidates that ran in every way. And my hope is that on the issues of student loan debt, climate, and gun violence, that they will lead the way. And Vice President Biden called me when I dropped out, Nicole, and he told me, you mentioned passing the torch, and he said, I hear you. And if I'm elected president, I promise to enable the next generation. And
awesome.
I'll take him at his word.
Congressman Eric Swalwell, the book is Endgame. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to meet you. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Thank you for all you're doing to be a voice of reason.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Hopefully you'll come back again after I've been able to read the whole book. Thank you so much, Congressman.
Thanks, Nicole.
Take care. Bye-bye. And with that, we are done. It's the end of a week. So thank you for listening, everybody. And I'll see you Monday. All right, with the immediate family. Oh boy, that's going to be a treat. Bye.